Hey everybody, welcome to this episode of the show. Today I'm joined by award-winning producer Alexandra Blue. She runs Bluebird Productions, who create work across the UK and Australia, and Alexandra's part of the inaugural BFI Insights program, which looks to support the next wave of producing talent in the UK to bring their feature films to the screen. Alexandra, thank you for joining me. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm very well, thank you, Ash.
Awesome. This is my standard question. How is lockdown life treating you? How's it been treating you? Like, how's work been in this period for you? What's it kind of been like?
So interestingly, I feel quite privileged because many people in the film industry are really suffering right now. But for me, it hasn't been so bad because I've been in development on various projects. And in funded development on those projects, which really makes a difference. So I've been okay, which has been great. And development is one of those things which can be done remotely without too much trouble. So loads of kind of Zoom calls with writers, that sort of thing. And just, yeah, really enjoying getting into that kind of stuff. I'm not planning on shooting anything until next year anyway. So hopefully things will be a little bit easier by then. But yeah, for me, lockdown has been a good opportunity to just, yeah, keep developing projects and kind of somewhat get a healthier work-life balance, which is kind of, you know, tricky as a producer, I think. I mean, it's tricky for everyone in the film industry, but I have been getting more sleep and looking after myself a little better than I usually do. So I guess that's the silver lining. So yeah, I've been quite fortunate compared to a lot of other people out there who are doing it really tough.
Yeah, it's been rough, I think, for the majority of us that are all freelancers. As soon as that you can't work in person thing goes out the window, it becomes a very difficult scenario. But there's always silver linings that we can find them, even if it's just the kind of perspective you were talking about of, you know, finding a better life balance and focusing on what's important and what we can control and trying to just take ownership of that. Do you feel like you've had more doors open a little bit in this time in terms of access? Do you feel like you've been able to get more conversations with people that maybe you otherwise wouldn't?
I'm not sure. I think for a lot of people that I'm dealing with in funding bodies and financiers, in lockdown, several of them have had to also become primary carer for the child. And yeah. So they're not necessarily as busy. I think it depends on what level of person you're trying to reach, though. Like the younger execs who maybe don't have kids and stuff like that can be a bit easier to access right now. For me, I'm easier for other people to access right now. I have actually been surprisingly busy. So the first couple of months of lockdown, I wasn't, but more recently, I've been able to have more chats with people and give more advice and stuff like that, which has been quite nice because I do really enjoy doing that. But at times, it can be a challenge to kind of squeeze it in. But I guess all that time that I'm saving and not traveling into Soho for meetings and stuff has meant that I can be, yeah, a bit more available to people, which has been nice.
And still have that time for yourself to live a little bit of your own life as well, right? Like that's
yeah, key. Trying
God forbid,
to for sure.
God forbid.
I feel like I haven't been working as late into the evenings as I used to. So evenings have actually been like, oh, I can watch some TV, or I should like can catch up to date on some things, or you know, start reading a book. So that has been a little bit, yeah, it's been a bit better with that aspect of things.
Awesome. Well, we'll maybe get into that later about the things you're watching and your tastes on sort of films and TV stuff. But I guess before we go any further, it might be good to take a few steps back and I guess talk a bit about your origin story in the whole producing world. How did you get into it? And what inspired you to get into it? Like, were you always conscious of it, or did it happen more sort of organically than that?
Sure. So I didn't study film. I always loved film, but I never saw it as a career path. I didn't realize it was really something that I personally could ever get a job in. It felt like this thing that other people did that largely probably lived in Hollywood. So it was never something that I was actively pursuing at the time. And what I had heard, I knew one person that worked in the film industry when I was in high school, and they said to me, the film industry is a very, very tough place for women. And they were like, I just wouldn't do it if I were you unless I was really sure that that's what you wanted to do. And I was like 15 at the time, and I was like, I have no idea what I want to do. Everything is just a loose idea. So I didn't study film, but whilst I was at uni, I did an arts degree. There were options to take electives, and one of those was video production, and another one was film studies. And I just found myself really enjoying those subjects and feeling like they weren't work in the way that the other subjects were. And I think when you find something that feels like it's not a chore, that's always a good sign. But I still didn't really think it was something that I could do. But I had a lecturer who was working in the industry, and we got along very well. And he knew that I was quite passionate about various things. And he said, look, why don't you do a bit of work for me? So I did a bit of, you know, part-time work for him around my studies. I think the first thing I did for him, I was a camera assistant on like a corporate video shoot. And I was a terrible camera assistant. I was not good. He was like, that's fine. Like, you know, we'll find something that's, you know, a bit better for you. And then I did a bit of coordinating work. And at the same time, I'd started volunteering on short films. And the first short film that I worked on, it was such a tiny crew. I think it was like 5 or 6 people. And they just said, do you want to come help out? And I was like, yeah. I didn't even have like a particular role. And what I naturally ended up doing was just kind of organizing things and telling people what to do and kind of keeping an eye on time and, you know, chatting to people and keeping them happy. And someone was like, oh, so you're the first AD. And I was like, I didn't even know what a first AD is at that point. but it seems like my personality and my skills were a good fit for it. So I started ADing on various shorts, having had like no formal training. And I did really enjoy ADing. I loved being on set. I loved being with people. You know, I liked kind of making the most out of each day and making sure I felt like the director had gotten as much as possible, because we were like really keeping an eye on the schedule. I enjoyed that aspect. But as I started going to these screenings of the films that I was working on, I was watching them, and sometimes I was thinking, oh, I don't know that aspect of the story is really working that well, or I feel like I would have done that differently. Or in some instances, just watching the film and thinking, I don't really like it. And I had this conversation with my mom after one particular screening, and she asked me to describe what I did. And I told her, and she was like, oh, like that's really great. That sounds like you worked really hard on it. And she was like, but you didn't have anything to do with the creative, did you? And I was like, oh. And it was that point I realized I was actually disappointed about not having that creative input. And that allowed me to realize that was something that I wanted to do. But I didn't have ambitions to direct or to write. But I didn't even know what a producer was at that point. Like, I literally had no idea. And someone said to me, why don't you try producing? And I was like, well, I don't really know what that involves, but sure, like, I'll try anything. So I started producing short films. And that's when I started to feel like I'd found something that genuinely was the right fit and that I was good at. And I think often when you start out with really small short films and people who are working at more of a student level, a producer can be, you know, wrongly seen as a production manager. And they often just think, oh, you're the person that just organizes the things, which isn't really what a true producer does. But as I kind of worked on more and more projects, I started to kind of, you know, flex my creative fingers and get really involved in development and, you know, overseeing the whole part of the process. And, you know, the producer is on something from beginning to end, and it does really become part of you. So I was very careful about the projects that I was choosing and, you know, things which reflected me as a producer and my taste. This was all whilst I was still at uni, and then I got offered a job working for a funding body in Australia. So that was my first gig, where I worked as a project officer. So I was assessing funding applications for various things. And that was fantastic. But what I realized was, when you work for the funding body, you can't apply for money from the funding body. That's a conflict of interest.
Well, yeah.
So I decided I would quit. And I was very fortunate to get offered a job at a post-production house. So I started out post-coordinating and post-producing eventually on feature films and TV series, which I really enjoyed. But it was always just something to kind of, you know, pay the bills and to keep learning whilst producing on the side. So I was starting to make bigger short films, bigger budgets with funding bodies. And I thought, how am I going to become this producer that I want to be? And how am I going to learn, you know, to be a creative producer? And I thought, what I really need is to be mentored by someone or to shadow someone. And so I started thinking about how I could do that and where I could do that. And ultimately, I decided I wanted to do that in the UK, because I'm originally from Australia. And there were just so many amazing production companies there, and the industry seemed to be really sustainable. And, you know, audiences in the UK were really watching and embracing UK films. And at the time, Australian audiences weren't necessarily really wanting to watch Australian films, which I found quite problematic. So I thought, yeah, I'm going to move to the UK. Didn't have any contacts in the UK. Wow. zero contacts. And I also knew that I couldn't walk into a job, because I didn't have experience as, you know, like a producer at that level. I didn't have any development experience. I barely knew what development was.
And it's more competitive just because it's a bigger market as well. So you probably had more people that had the experience or maybe a known school they'd come out of that maybe did in their stead.
Definitely. So I kind of was like, how on earth am I going to try and achieve this? And I decided I would try and apply for a scholarship because I thought if there's someone else paying my wage, that makes me a much easier person to bring in and also easier for me to be like, teach me. Because that's what I really wanted. I wanted someone to kind of, you know, to guide me through. So I applied for a bunch of scholarships in Australia, ended up getting one, which was great. Got myself a mentorship with Warp Films, yep. And that was quite difficult to get.
In London, right? Not in Sheffield.
In London. Yep. In London. I did occasionally travel to Sheffield, but I was based in the London office. And I was able to kind of offer them some help with the post-production side of things. So I said, look, I can help you with that side of things and I can help with funding applications and stuff based on my background if you could teach me and let me in on the development side of things, and that's what I want to learn from you. Because I had the scholarship, it wasn't considered an unpaid internship, so that was really helpful. So I did that for 6 months. It was brilliant. Then I was very fortunate to be offered another scholarship from Screen Australia with their Talent Escalator program, which is for producers who are kind of stepping up. They set me up with Element Pictures. I had a fantastic 6 months with them. And then I ended up staying on and working for them part-time after I finished, which I loved. But ultimately, can't survive in London on a part-time wage. So I ended up moving to Heyday to work in development there. And then spent 2 years working at Heyday, all the while kind of, you know, developing my own projects on the side, feature slate, as well as producing short films. So in the UK, I had support from various different funding bodies to make my short films. So producing had kind of, you know, become the goal, but everything else I was doing was kind of contributing to my skill as a producer until I got to a point where I was comfortable leaving full-time employment to just focus on producing full-time.
But you were you were making your shorts whilst you were in full-time employment and
working.
So you weren't doing one and then postponing the other.
No, so I was using all of my annual leave to make short films. So I was never having any holidays. And what I used to do was I used to go into work an hour or an hour and a half early every day, and I would spend that time working on my own projects, and then I would stay an hour to an hour and a half later in the evening. So kind of I was having these longer days, but I was dedicating beginning and end to my own stuff so that I could still keep pushing them along.
Do you feel like that was the thing you did consciously to give yourself the discipline of, I'm not at home, so I can't fall into any trap of some other distraction. I'm forcing myself to get that habit of...
Definitely. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And particularly because the office was so quiet at that time. So it meant that, you know, I could really focus and it was quite helpful just, yeah, being able to zone in on that. And at the time I was living in a share house as well with like, you know, five people as you do in London. And that wasn't a really conducive environment for focusing in the morning when people like about getting breakfast and shower schedule.
Fighting over the bathroom. So, yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
And so... Because what I find interesting about the whole thing that you just said there is that you were always coming to the UK with that idea of getting knowledge. It wasn't so much, give me a job. I mean, it was, as you say, you need to live. But it was about getting something out of it beyond that. And also, I thought was interesting that you said you came in offering value. Like, you saw that you had some value to give. It wasn't just hire me because I need something from you. You figured out what you could bring to the table, even if it was early on. That must be a key thing for anyone starting out, even if they're not, you know, laden with credits or experience, they'll have some value that they can bring to the table. What would you recommend to a lot of people fresh out of, you know, studying or just wanting to get into it to follow a similar sort of path, like intern, work for free, or whatever you have to do?
The work for free thing, so I have an ethical issue with people having to work for free. Unfortunately, is the way our industry is currently structured, so I don't really want to condone it necessarily. If you are going to do, you know, free work, make sure that it is at least expenses paid. That's very reasonable to request, and make sure there is a cap on your time. So I think in the UK, you're only actually able to work for a maximum of 4 weeks, you know, expenses only in an internship. And even that, I don't think is brilliant. But it's the way it is right now. So if you can do that, you're in a privileged position, because for a lot of people, they can't afford to work for a month, you know, full time without earning any other income. But if you've able to, you know, have a part-time job in advance, save up, use some leave, or, you know, even try and negotiate with a company and see if you could do a part-time internship, if, you know, that financial barrier is one for you. Because I do believe that this industry has a problem where we end up having a lack of diversity because the only people that can afford to do unpaid internships, you know, are a certain person. So it is problematic. But if you are able to take on that kind of opportunity, absolutely go for it. If you're not able to take that on, try and negotiate something that works for your personal circumstances instead, because I think companies should be trying to be open to that. And also look at paid internship opportunities, because there are several out there. There's not, you know, a complete wealth of paid internships, but they do exist. So definitely look at those as a first point of call. And then consider, you know, volunteering your time on things which might be a little bit easier on you. For example, short films and things like that, they're usually shooting just for a couple of days. Often a couple of days of your time is much easier to give around other paid work. That sort of thing can be great. You build your connections that way. You start to build a reputation. That's really helpful.
I guess it depends the caliber of company you're going to, right? Like if it's the case of a Heyday or a Warp, who, I mean, it sounds awful, but it's the reality. It's going to look good on a resume, but also you're probably going to learn things there that you might not at a different level. So dependent on the role and the access, there is the opportunity there to get quite a lot out of it. But I guess it's always with the caveat of still making and producing your own stuff and creating your slate, no matter what stage you're at. I mean, if you had to pick, would you say go and get the experience working somewhere? Or would you say actually, no, make like now in this modern era, just make your own stuff? Like, do you feel one outweighs the other at all?
I think it depends a little bit on what you want to achieve within the film industry. So if you're a director, go out and make your stuff. Like, that's going to be the thing which gets you attention. Mm-hmm. If you say want to work in development, you know, then maybe, you know, going into a production company is a good space to be. It depends a little bit on where you see yourself. Sure. For me, a combination of both was really important, because I learned so much from being in those companies. But equally, I think with producing, you do learn the most by actually just doing it. So for me, it was definitely dual prong strategy. But yeah, I think you have to look at what role you want to do. And also, like, sometimes it takes time to figure out what that is. A lot of people, you know, they do an internship and then they're like, actually, I would not like to do this job. And that's, you know, a valuable thing to learn in itself. But you still might make connections that help you do something that you do want to do.
Sure. It's, I guess, like, you know, you saying that you did post-prod work back in Australia, which you didn't really want to do, but it added value to then getting a role and doing something in a different capacity later. And
yeah,
I guess,
I did enjoy the work. It's not like I hated it, but it, you know, it served a purpose.
Sure. Disclaimer. Just in case. And, you know, by looking at the list of obviously work you've done a lot of short films, and which I find really interesting. And also I think reassuring, because I like the short film format. I've made a few myself. I think there was a period in time where, like, way back when, people used to say, make your short film, it'll be like your calling card. And then eventually there seemed to be this window where people stopped saying that. It was almost like, nah, don't waste your time on short films. Like, you know, make a mini series on YouTube, or make, like, you know, a micro budget feature. Just skip that step. I don't know what your thoughts are. It feels like now short films definitely have a firm foothold back in the market again. Obviously, they're not profitable, but there's more of a desire for them to be curated, for people to see them. Do you still feel like that's a good way to go for anybody wanting to cut their teeth to make as many of those as they can?
Absolutely. I still think short films are very important, and I think they are a calling card. I think that it really depends as well on the kind of films that you're wanting to make. So often when people say, oh, you should just go and make something for YouTube, you should just do like a web series, my argument to that is, if you want to be a dramatic feature filmmaker with like a really cinematic vision, making something for no budget on YouTube is not really going to showcase who you are as a director. And equally, it's probably not actually going to work that well in that format. YouTube tends to work well for kind of, you know, with those short videos, it's often comedy content, or it's kind of zeitgeisty. It's a different type of storytelling. Mm-hmm. So by making a web series, you're not necessarily honing the storytelling skills that you're going to need when you make a feature film. I mean, I don't think that applies to all circumstances, but in general, that's my perspective. And a short film, I think often you can make something really fantastic with the resources that you have. It's very difficult to make a micro budget feature and make that well. I mean, to start off with micro budget features, you kind of have to do that for no money. Again, you've got to be in a position of privilege for that. You're going to have to get some money. Where are you going to get that from? Unless you have wealthy friends, again, going to be quite difficult. It's really tough. I do think, yeah, that it is a model at the moment. And I really admire people who do make micro budget features because I think it's incredibly challenging. And occasionally you do make it, you do see a brilliant micro budget feature and that does push the filmmaker forward. But I don't think that's the main way that filmmakers are kind of, you know, carving their path at the moment. I think it's still a lot of, you know, really successful short film that does well at, you know, festivals. Was backed by a funding body. And the other thing is, creating a short film with a funding body means you're building that relationship. So when you go back to them to try and get a feature up and running, they know you, they know your work, they trust you, they're more likely to invest in you. So, you know, making that short film with them can be a really critical part of, you know, pushing yourself forward as a feature filmmaker as well, with them in mind.
And I guess, you know, I guess we'll talk about the funding bodies a little bit more, but obviously not everybody's going to get access to the funding body to get funding for their shorts, because there's only X amount of funding available and not a whole load of funding bodies in the UK to tap into. But I guess with a short, if you are self-financing, which you don't want to do that often, but if you do it once, it's not going to be as huge a chunk of change to put in there. And it's an investment that if it gets on the festival circuit, then opens up doors to then moving on to maybe getting funding from a body next time around. So it's a more palatable kind of approach, I suppose. Have you always taken the approach of working with the funding bodies, or have you also looked at other ways of getting funding for shorts outside of just, say, BFI, Creative England, and those people?
So when I started out, almost everything I've done has been with a funding body. So that's the model that I think that's my strength as a producer. I tend to lean more towards public funding body model. And I think that model works quite well in the UK and in Australia. It doesn't work so well in the US because they don't have a public funding body system. But for me, that's kind of how I know how to do things. And I've always had the funding body cash as like the core aspect of the finance plan. And I've used kind of having that funding body almost as a stamp of approval to then raise other funds. But it's very rare for me to do something without a funding body. So I do think that's quite important. I think that, you know, if you can, yeah, if you've got access to money, go and make something yourself. It's fantastic. Because now we're in a position where funding bodies often want you to have already done one short film without them. And then they come on board your second or third, which is tricky, and again presents a diversity problem, but we won't get into that now. I do think funding bodies are fantastic if you can get to them, but yes, there may be a couple of steps first. I feel like I slightly lost track of the question there, so if I haven't answered it, let me know and I will.
I forgot what the question was, to be fair. I was just listening that attentively, so I'm sure it was answered somewhere in there, and if not, there'll be a nugget that we can get for people to use. But no, I think it's interesting that there's a few more steps now to maybe get access to that funding, but it's still available. How do you say someone wants to approach one of these funding bodies for their first or second or third short film, they're an early stage filmmaker, what are some of the things in your experience that they look for as sort of really key things to stand out for them to consider even giving you any money? Is it genre and theme based? Is it the quality of your, you know, production breakdown and the finance approach that you broke? Like, what tips?
So actually, I think when it comes to getting funding for a short film, the financial approach is often the last thing they think about. So the first thing is usually script. It's like, do they like the script? Do they respond to it? Do they think it's well written? And do they think there has already been a film like this that's been made? So you want to be doing something that feels original. It feels like a unique take on it. You want to have a strong voice. Yeah. It depends a little bit whether you're a writer director or you've got a writer and a separate director as well. So if you've got a separate director who hasn't written the screenplay, then they often want to know, why is this person the right person to direct it? You know, preferably see some of their previous work, just to know that the vision is in safe hands with this person and why they're the right person to direct it. And it may be that they've come from a different medium. Like sometimes you see people coming over from the theatre side of things, or transitioning. Sometimes it's, you know, a writer who's going to direct for the first time. So lots of different kind of approaches, but I think funding bodies want to know that you've got this original, you know, this original project and vision for it. And usually they don't worry too much about the funding side of things and the finance plan and the budget, unless you've written something which is like clearly a massive budget and it's just not going to be achievable for what you're asking for. Say your budget's not perfect and there are a few things in there which are unrealistic, but they love the project. Them loving the project is the important thing. They'll figure out the budget side of it with you later, you know, and say to you, oh, we think that you haven't put enough in for locations or whatever it is, or we think that you're, you know, spending too much in a certain area. They will probably say that to you. It's not going to be the reason they decline a project. So for those of you out there who are newer producers, I think you want to do a good budget and do the best you can. But don't feel like the budget's going to be, the whole project's going to be not funded because you know, did one line wrong in the budget. That's highly unlikely.
And as you said earlier, you can always obviously use that to secure a chunk of the core budget, but then that's your proof to go to other people to get extra bits that you need to fill in things, whether it's on post. Definitely. Or a location that's a bit more expensive or whatever it might be. It's not that you're saying to Absolutely. The funding body, give me the 100% funding.
And actually, that's really a good thing to raise, because previously it was far more common that the funding body would give you the full budget. But now funds are stretched a lot more thin than they were, you know, 5-10 years ago. And so I think the first couple of short films I made, it was just the funding body paying for it and that was it. But everything I've made in the past, say, 3 years has been a combination. Often the funding body is, you know, supportive of you coming to them and saying, we need 15K. We're going to apply for 10 from you and we're going to raise 5 on Kickstarter, or we're going to get 5 from private investors or whatever that is. And they kind of view that as a plus because they don't have to put in as much. They can spread their budget, you know, across more projects, which means they get more out of their money, but they know you're still able to make the project if you are able to access a little bit of other finance.
Yeah, which makes sense. And it gives, I guess, the people behind the film a little bit more of a relaxed view on it because they're not putting all their eggs in one basket and relying on all of that from them. This is just me thinking out loud, and I'm wondering if it's a complete nonsensical thought, but there can be that idea of, if I work with a funding body, are they going to want to have a little bit more creative input or control over the story? I'm assuming that's not the case, but in your experience, do they ever kind of want to?
I think they do want to be involved in the creative, right. Is my experience. Yeah, they definitely want to be involved. But I think once you get to know them, usually that can be a good thing because they've been across so many short films. They've developed far more short films than you ever will be across in your life. Mm-hmm. They work a lot with script and writers, so they often have interesting contributions. They always want to support the filmmaker's vision, so then they never usually come down too hard on things. Like I've never seen, for example, in an edit them say you have to make this change. Contractually, usually they do actually have the right to do that, but it's very rare that they would ever kind of, you know, pull that card. Because they want the filmmaker to make the film they want to make. It's not the funding body's calling card, it's the filmmakers. They want
I think, yeah,
you.
That's more where I was coming from, that from a filmmaker starting out, they want that freedom to express their creative vision as much as possible.
Yeah.
With the right guidance, because they have the gap of experience and it's the balance that you're
totally.
Looking for.
So it's a conversation, and you know, if you've got really good reasons why you don't want to take on board a particular no, like usually everyone's like, okay, we get it, like, and we'll pass on that. It's a compromise, but filmmaking is always a collaboration, and that involves with your financiers.
What are you talking about? No, it's pure play for dictators just to get in there and run the show and run amok. No, I think leading on from that. You kind of alluded to it, obviously the people that you work with, directors, director, writers, that combination. For you, what draws you to gravitate towards certain people that you look at and go, I want to collaborate with them on this project, or over time, maybe down the line, work with them and put them on your roadmap? What is it for you as a person and a creative that resonates with you?
So I think for me, it's about feeling that something is original and bold and kind of interesting in some way. And it has to be a story that I emotionally connect with in some way. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to, you know, directors and writers, it's usually about finding someone that I think we have similar tastes and that we're excited by the same things. But it also has to be someone that I can imagine myself spending hours and hours in conversation with them. So you have to kind of like really gel, because when you make even a short film, often that's like a 3-year relationship, you know, and the short film is like having a baby together. Like you have to A, get along with this person, and B, kind of, you know, share the same vision for the project and, you know, be able to laugh together. And also there has to be trust. I think trust is so important. And I know often for newer filmmakers, trusting a producer is very difficult. And, you know, sometimes people think that the producers are out to get them and crazy things like that. And majority of the time, the producer is not.
What do you think that is? Do you think that's like the Hollywood perception of, like, you know, the Harvey Weinsteins of the world that have given that really bad rap to people in the production?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe. I think it comes from a fear that someone wants to take something away from you, maybe.
Want to steal their baby. I mean, that's frightening.
Yeah, which is not the case. You know, we're all about, you know, making the thing the best thing it can be. And also we're going to put a huge amount of time and effort into your project. So we've got to love it. But yeah, finding those people that you have that good creative relationship with is really important. Because it's everything. You pair with the wrong person and it's not going to go well.
It's going to end in divorce.
The nice thing is that a short film is a test. A short film is a great way to test the relationship and know, do I want to make a feature film with this person?
Sure. Yeah. Absolutely. I could wax lyrical with all kinds of questions that have come to mind, but I'm mindful that there is someone in the waiting room. So instead of making them wait, I'll shut up, bring them in, and let them have a bit of a chat with you, and we can circle back to any other questions later. So this is Sean. He's a director going into third year. Hello, Sean. How you doing?
Hi. How are you?
Good to see you. So you're on with Alexandra. I'm going to basically just shut up for a while and let you kind of have a bit of a chat with her and introduce yourself and ask any questions you got for her.
Perfect. Yeah, I'm happy with that.
Cool. Over
Hi,
to you.
Hi, Sean. Nice to meet you.
Hi, you too. So I don't know how much Ashley told you, but I'm kind of
nothing
at all, no introduction at all. Nope. Okay. Well, I'm kind of, I like to think of myself as a new filmmaker or represent that kind of demographic, I guess. But I'm kind of interested in the relationship with new directors and new producers and how that usually works. Like, is it common for someone like me trying to get into the industry to actually have someone equally sort of inexperienced come up as a producer with me, or would I find somebody who's already established? And kind of how would you actually go about finding a producer partner, if that makes sense?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. So I think essentially I'm a real fan of finding people who are at a similar level to you and kind of finding your cohort. And I think if you look at a lot of successful producer-director relationships, they did meet when they were quite young. You know, look at like Shane Meadows and the relationship, you know, he has with Warp and places like that. Often, you know, you meet your allies and people that, you know, you have a good relationship with really early on in your career. And if that relationship goes well, you stick together and you continue to make things together for a really long time. So I'm a big advocate for that. Obviously I can see the appeal in trying to approach a more experienced producer. They know what they're doing. You're a bit newer to the process. They have a lot to offer you. But similarly, more experienced producers are often focused on features and you might not necessarily be their first priority and they might not be able to give you as much time as a newer producer will. And I think there's something quite nice as well if you're both kind of new at something, is there's less of a fear of making a mistake in front of the other person because you're both new to it and you're growing together. So that can be really lovely. There are instances where someone makes a short film with a really green producer and then a bigger producer comes in and snaps them up for the next short film. And sometimes that can be the right thing. It really depends on the relationship that you have, the project you're trying to make. Say, for example, you've done a really small, low budget short film and your next project is something massively high budget and very challenging and your producer has only ever made one short film. Then maybe you might need to consider having a more experienced pair of hands on board, but that doesn't necessarily need to mean that the producer you did your first short film with needs to step away completely. Maybe there's a collaboration. Maybe you take on board an experienced executive producer to kind of, you know, work with the younger producer. Because I think what's quite sad is a lot of times directors will make a short film with someone and then they just get snapped up and the producer gets left behind, and it's really hard for that producer to progress their career. And I think that's a real shame. So I think finding ways to continue those relationships and mentor those producers as well and push them up too is really important from a producer perspective. But also for you, if you've found someone that you've got a really good creative collaboration with, don't let that go, because that's so hard to find. And I found majority of my creative relationships when I was starting out, and they are my strongest relationships, and I'm still working with those talent today. So what's generally happened for me is I've made a short film with someone and then we've gone on to develop the feature together. And we're doing that with, you know, funding bodies, and, you know, continuing on that creative relationship. So I think look for people that feel like the right creative fit, and don't worry too much about their level of experience, because with producing, if they surround themselves by the right level of people and they know the right people to ask, and they're aware of what they don't know, then I think they can still do a really good job of producing a short film with you.
Perfect.
I'm not sure if that answered the question. Did I miss any part of the question there? You asked about how the relationship works. Do you want me to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, kind of. I think it's just sort of a gray area. You don't really get told a lot about what to do sort of after uni or anything like that. And at the moment, I'm in a position where, and I'm sure a lot of people are in the same position, where they have no idea what's going to happen in the next few years. I might not even be going back to uni this year. And I'm thinking more and more about just trying to rely on, you know, my own sort of creativity and be more responsible for just making things and seeing how that works. But I know that there's no set path either. And it's the same with working with anybody like a producer or anybody in the industry. So yeah, if you have any sort of thoughts on that or anything like that.
Yeah, so I think it's great to kind of, you know, make as much as you can. Ash and I were talking earlier about, you know, where to invest your energy and should you like try and get an internship or should you just go out and make things. And I think if you want to be a filmmaker, make things as much as you can, because that's, you learn the most from actually doing it. And also it creates things that show people who you want to be as a filmmaker. But definitely great to look for the right people to kind of embark on that journey with you. So I think in terms of finding producers, I mean, my approach to finding writers and directors is I tend to look for their previous work. So if I've seen their film at a film festival or something like that, but if you're, you know, if you're in the middle of uni and you haven't had the chance to create a body of work yet, I know that can be really difficult. So I think, are you a writer, director, or are you focusing on directing?
Yeah, no, I love writing my own things as well. I haven't had a chance to have an original script by myself yet that I've directed, but I've rewritten things I've worked on before. So yeah, definitely.
Great. So I think if you're able to write something that you want to direct, you know, and you have that there in script format, if it's a good script, you know, you'll be able to find someone that wants to pair up with you on that. And so what I would be doing is maybe looking at other short films that have been made recently that you love, and thinking, okay, that producer seems like they have the same taste as me, maybe I might send my script to them. And obviously in the current situation, it's a bit harder to network, but networking is a really important part of things. So once things go a little bit more back to normal and we can go to film festivals are a great place just to meet people. So going to screenings, talking to people afterwards, going to the events, the parties, that kind of thing is really helpful. But otherwise, you know, searching online and looking for people that you think share a similar sensibility to you and kind of reaching out to them. But also, I'm sure, you know, being at uni, there must be other people that, you know, are interested in producing and that kind of thing. So looking there as well, and also seeking recommendations. So I think, you know, asking everyone you know, who they know, putting you in touch, that sort of thing. So I get a lot of projects sent to me via recommendation. So that's how I get the majority of projects. If someone has said, you should talk to Alex, this would be her kind of thing.
No, that's perfect.
And I think in terms of the relationship and how it works, it depends very much on the producer. But I think the best relationships start at the very beginning. So I like to be approached when there's like a first draft of the script, or even when there's just an idea, if it's a filmmaker that I've worked with before, really happy to get involved at that stage. What I don't like is being approached when someone emails me and they say, I've got this film, I need a producer, and what I just need is for someone to just organize this shoot and raise the money for me.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, that's not interesting to me at all.
And it's not really a producer, right? Sorry, it's not really. No. I mean, it is, but you're not just the money people, unless you have a pot of gold under your bed that we don't know about.
Yeah, totally. Essentially what that person is asking is for, you know, almost like an EP and a production manager in one, which isn't really what we tend to do. So I want to be involved, like early conversations about the project and like talking a lot about the script, about the characters, like getting into it, really having those discussions, understanding the vision that you have for the film. So knowing what your references are, you know, looking at any mood boards that you might put together, getting a strong sense of what this project is. And then, you know, giving script notes, that kind of thing, and then deciding what the best approach is for moving it forward, you know, whether we think this is a no budget thing or whether we think we might be able to get a funding body on board. And then I'll kind of look after the financing. During the shoot, I will be there to kind of, you know, talk to you about stuff, you know, make creative decisions. So like, well, I usually sit in on the HOD interviews if I can, if I've got enough time. Making those choices together, also casting really important, making those choices together, you know, being there for you throughout the shoot, not just to kind of, you know, problem solve practical problems, but also creative problems. So if a scene's not working, having conversation, if we're short on time, we know we can't shoot anything, what is the least important thing that we feel like we can get away with for the storytelling, that kind of thing. And then in post, I often come by to the edit, I'll sit in there, give notes, work through things. So I'm quite involved from kind of all stages, and then film festivals, kind of, you know, overseeing that. Often I actually employ a company to submit to the film festival for me. I have a great company that I usually work with, overseeing the marketing materials. So making sure we like have a great poster and a trailer if possible. And then, you know, talking next steps, like what are we going to do together now? If the relationship's gone well, let's develop a feature idea. Let's have that ready to, you know, talk about when the film's out in film festivals. So you kind of hope it's going to be an ongoing relationship, and something that you'll continue working together after you've made the short film. But it's definitely a close relationship. It's really important. And it's what makes the journey a lot of fun a lot of the time, is that creative collaboration and those discussions and the late nights and the laughing at, you know, ridiculous things that go wrong during the shoot.
After the shoots happen, because during that ain't funny. That shit's not funny during the shoot at all. That's like the worst in the world.
It's very true.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
No, I think that more than answers all the questions. And yeah, I think it's just something, you know, a lot of people like myself, there is no guidebook at the moment. But then you realize that you talk to people like yourself or other people in the industry, and they actually do have sort of strategies or things that they want to tell you about that you just don't hear otherwise, unless you, you know, talk to people. And yeah, I think that's what I'm learning more and more, is to just keep talking to people, keep getting out there and making things, like you say. And I always have it in my head that as long as what I make is going to be good, then it's going to work out for me. So
definitely,
that might be, but that's just how I like to
think. Not at all. I think as well, like, two of the most important things in the film industry are like attitude, like, and being hardworking. Like, if you've got a good attitude and you're nice, people generally really want to help you. And also remembering that we were all in your position at one point. So I remember when I started out, I was very apprehensive to ask anyone for their time, for their help, or ask questions, because I was like, oh, why would they help me? And they're really busy and I'm not important. But ultimately, we remember what it was like to be there. And most of us want to help other people. We really genuinely do. And I guess that's the one advantage of the current situation, is that some people have a bit more time, which Ash and I were just talking about before. So now is a good time to like ask for help and advice and that kind of thing, because people might be a little bit more able to give it. And there is no guidebook for filmmaking. You can read as many books as you want, but going out there and doing it and talking to people about it, I think that's the best teacher, really. Your film degree will put you in, you know, a great position, because obviously you'll get so much from that, but you also just get so much from doing it and from failing. Like, don't necessarily expect the first thing you make to be genius, because you know, you have to be prepared to fail, particularly if you want to be like a really successful filmmaker, because you've got to take risks, you've got to be bold, and you know, try different things in order to stand out from the like the absolute swarm of short films out there. So you've kind of got to be okay with sometimes things not going exactly how you wanted.
Perfect.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Food for thought.
Definitely, I feel a lot better now.
Cool. All right, dude. Thanks for joining. I'm glad it was helpful. I'll touch base with you soon.
Yeah, perfect. Nice meeting you as well.
Nice meeting you, Sean. And if you want to ask anything else, Ash can give you my email address. You can stay in touch.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Thank you very much, then.
Take it easy.
Good luck with everything.
Bye.
See you later, Sean. See, it's so much better when other people get involved and it's not just me making stuff up on a whim. I do have more people waiting. Before we get to the next one, I think an interesting distinction to make, just for anyone listening who might be a bit green, might be around the exec producer and producer comment you made in that chat with Sean, because obviously there are slight distinctions. Could you maybe just elaborate on if someone's coming on as an exec producer, the kind of involvement they would have compared to being full-on producer all
sure.
in?
Sure. Producing credits is like a really difficult thing, because often you see producing credits and you're like, I have no idea what that means. And there is no necessarily standard way of doing it, because in many instances, some people get producing credits because they have put money in. So it doesn't necessarily mean they did a certain role. So it can be really hard to know what a credit really means. Yeah. In film, traditionally, an exec producer is more of a financing role or a mentoring role. So sometimes the funding body, they might have execs that worked on your projects that might receive an exec producer credit. If you had a private financier put money in, then they're probably going to want an exec producer credit. They won't necessarily have any creative input, but they've put money in, so they might get an exec producer for that reason. Or sometimes if you've got a really green producer that might need a bit of help and mentorship, then they might potentially ask someone to EP it in order to sort of, you know, get some guidance, and they give an EP credit in return. So there can be different instances of the EP credit. But traditionally with feature films, it's often, you know, more involved at the financing level. But sometimes if it's a financier that, you know, is also creatively involved, like a Film 4 or BFI, then, you know, that individual didn't necessarily put in money, but they gave their creative input and they helped get that project up and running. And therefore, they're going to get an EP credit, because without their involvement, you know, that money wouldn't have been attached.
Yep.
In TV, it works differently.
Of course.
If you want me to explain how it works in TV, I can. Is it worth me explaining that?
Can we do it in a Cliff Notes version for in a few minutes, or should I bring people in?
Yeah, that's fine. No, we can park it and discuss.
Let's circle back to it at the end, because then there's also my mind going, and what about associate producers? So rather than make these poor guys wait, let me bring in the next one, and then we can circle back at the end. So let's bring in Ruben, who, bless him, I think has been waiting for at least 10-15 minutes, and hopefully he's still here. Hello,
he is. Hi guys, how's it going?
How you doing, Ruben?
Yeah, I'm good.
Awesome, nice to see you. I know.
Yeah, nice to meet you.
I'm going to shut up, which is my time to take a breather and give Alexandra relax from me and just let you have a chat with her for a bit and ask any questions that you've got for her, man.
Yeah, no worries. Cheers, man.
Cool.
Hi, Alexandra. Nice to meet you. When Ashley told me about yourself, you know, I was looking at what you've done. The amazing catalogue that you've got.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Really kind.
Some stuff really popping out to me, like you having worked on The Lobster and films like that. Just yeah, it's really extraordinary. I wanted to ask a few questions, if that's all right.
Go for it.
Currently being, had you, since I've now just finished film school, did you attend yourself? And if so, what was your opinion on it? Because, you know, a lot of people say, like, you hear a lot of people who have made it say, oh, it's not worth it and stuff like that. But I took a lot from it, so I was wondering what your sort of opinion on that would be.
So I didn't go to film school, but I did take film-related electives within my course. So I did an arts degree, and I did one class which was video production, and one which was film studies. And it actually enabled me to realize that maybe film was a career that I could pursue, which I hadn't really necessarily realized before, which Ash and I were talking about. And what it did for me was it kind of gave me some confidence, and also it connected me with my lecturer who worked in the industry. And he kind of enabled me to see that I could potentially get employment in this area, and also connected me to a bunch of people outside of the uni. So, you know, my degree did help in that regard. It helped kind of me realize that A, I could do it, and B, it put me in touch with people that could help me do it. I have a lot of friends that went to film school, and a lot of the writers and directors that I work with have gone to film school. Not all of them. It's maybe 50-50 split. I think it is valuable. Like, certainly you learn so much and you get to experiment. And if you get to make short films as part of that degree, that's fantastic. I think the making of things is really important, like just actually getting to do it. I don't think it teaches you everything, but no degree does. You know, you always learn a lot, you know, from being out there in the real world. But I think it's a great place to also meet peers that might be future collaborators. I was saying to actually Sean, who was on before, that, you know, meeting people at your stage is so important, because here's where you can find some really exciting people that you continue to work with for the years that come. You know, if you find really interesting creative collaborators from film school, then that's fantastic, because they'll be really key to kind of, you know, moving you forward.
Right, yeah. No, I totally get that, and see what you're saying about not needing a necessity for it. But I think it was what you said about, you know, you get the opportunity to make sort of stuff that you wouldn't normally. And there's that sort of, there's a reduced amount of problems that could happen if, you know, stuff does go wrong, like recuperations, if you get a bit more of a leeway to, you know, experiment.
Totally. And that's what's so important, is getting to experiment and take risks and to be able to fail and it being okay. Like, that's really important part of developing yourself as a filmmaker, I think. So that's, you know, that's really fantastic. And also, you can't sniff at like getting free gear. Like, if your film school has gear and you can just use it and make stuff, that's amazing. Because a lot of the barrier to other people who haven't gone to film school making their early short films is gear is really expensive to hire. So, like, you know, just having that environment in which you can make things, and, you know, people that, you know, have experience that you can ask and, you know, support you, that's so valuable. I think it's, you know, it is a great thing to do if it's something that's accessible for you. So,
yeah. I also wanted to ask, your production company is in such a astounding position now, and you seem to be very successful with everything that's going on with that. When people, well, I'm assuming now people come up to you asking about making things now. And I wanted to ask, at what sort of stage do you expect projects to be in, or, you know, the history of the person pitching and what they've done in their previous work? Mm-hmm. At what point do you say, right, okay, I'm not going to really listen to you because you haven't proved this, 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 and this before, perhaps taking something to another stage?
So when I first started out, I would look at like anything that was sent to me. But now that I've done like a large number of short films, I'm kind of moving into features. If someone were to approach me and they had a short film, but they'd never directed anything before, I'd probably be a bit like, this might not be one for me, but I might be able to point them in the direction of somebody else. Sometimes there are exceptions to that rule, though. So say, for example, I have one project on my slate where she's an experienced writer and she wants to transition into directing. And I kind of was like, actually, that's still an attractive proposition for me because, you know, she's been doing really well on the writing front. She's had, you know, funded projects. I really believe in her as a writer. I think she could be exciting as a director. But if it was someone that had come straight out of film school, I'd probably be like, I'm not sure that I can prioritize this project right now because I'm trying to balance, you know, the feature films and give them enough a time and attention. And also, I think it would be taking the opportunity away from a producer that could really benefit from doing a short film. Because now I'm in a position where I've done so many. For me, I still do short films occasionally, but I do them because I want to make a feature with that filmmaker. And I'm usually making a short with them so that the funding body can see what I see in them and kind of have, you know, either a proof of concept or, you know, just something which acts as a calling card. And I know that that's a step in between to getting their feature up and running. And also for me, it's a great way to build that relationship with them by doing this short film together. Whereas, you know, if it's a really new writer director, I kind of think there's probably an amazing producer out there who really would benefit from doing this short film and learning from it. Whereas I do learn from every short film that I do, but someone else is going to get a lot more out of it. And I don't really want to take that opportunity for them. But that being said, occasionally I do like mentor producers or EPs. So, like, you know, if I really liked the project, then maybe I would take on that kind of role instead. So I hope that answers it.
No, that's
you're answering the questions. Don't worry. You don't have to keep circling back. Just for Ruben's sake, like a few times, Alexander keeps kind of giving these amazing insights. And then after the few minutes of saying, there's like, did I even answer your questions? Like, you're answering.
Yeah, I feel like I go off on a tangent. Yeah.
No, it is a lot more beneficial for you. Yeah.
Ruben, are you going to go into directing now as a focus now that you've graduated? Or
I hope so. I mean, I feel like I've been lucky because I've sort of come out with it knowing what I am, what I think I'm good at and what I enjoy doing mostly, like, especially having done you know, that big week with you, Ashley, and everyone else, just being around people and constantly and specifically actors in that shooting environment was, you know, really beneficial to me, and I learned a lot.
Yeah, we're an awful bunch. We're an awful bunch. If you can handle us, then you're going to be okay.
Well, that's where I think I get my most, you know, the satisfaction from it all. Like, specifically, there was a bit during that shoot week where you and the rest of the guys, we had to do some improvisation and stuff. And, you know, we spoke for about 5 minutes and then we sent you off. And just, you know, seeing you guys in the corner doing improv while we were setting up to just shoot you off the cuff, it was really satisfying to look at because it came off really well. And I think it's one of the funniest bits, for me at least, in the film, because it's, you know, dialogue that I hadn't heard before. And it was just satisfying to see, right, okay, I'm going to try doing it like this. And it worked. And, you know, I still...
I guess it's Alex's point of, like, you kind of cut your teeth by doing it. So you sort of know what your style is the more you do your own films, and yeah, how you work, not just with actors, but with heads of department and producers. And
definitely,
you got to find your own vibe and your own tribe, I guess, would be the thing.
100%. Like, there's definitely people that were on that I immediately want to work with again. Like, Vicky, the director of photography, she was outstanding on everything during that. And really was almost the glue for everything, more than I probably should have been. But
do you feel, yeah, Ruben, that you made a short film that's a good calling card for you, that you then think this says, like, who I am as a director?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, like, I think genre-wise, I want to stick to hopefully doing, you know, light-hearted comedy stuff, but maybe a bit more black comedy. I'm not really sure yet. The film that we've just done is very surreal in its humour. I'm glad I've done it, and I got to really try out working with some weird characters and some weird stylistic choices. So now I think, more than anything, instead of doing something like that again, I know I've got the spectrum of what I can do from compared to what I've done before, and there's like a good medium to be able to work in between that. But I think I've definitely started figuring out how I go about making things. Which I know is a really broad statement, but I think I've learned a lot just in that 1 year having done that film. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. Awesome, man. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
I hope you got something positive out of it. Alex answered your questions with a whole load of nuggets there. So when I get around to editing this, I'll send you the link and you can watch it back and soak it back in again.
Yeah, cheers, man. Yeah, stay safe, guys.
Likewise.
Nice to meet you, Ruben.
Take it easy, Ruben. Bye. Oh, he left before I could remove him. God, didn't give me the satisfaction. There's one more in the waiting room, I think. I'll bring him in, and then we'll circle back to some questions and wrap it up after then. And so Hugo here, who's coming in, is actually a writer. I don't think he has aspirations to be a director. I don't want to put words in his mouth, but... Okay. He's a writer. Hey, Hugo.
Hey.
Good to see you. Good. How you doing?
Good to see you too. I'm well, thanks. How are you guys?
Awesome. I'm enjoying the lag. say hi to Alexandra. I'm going to be quiet and just let you guys have a chat. The only thing she knows about you is that you're a writer, and that's it.
Okay.
Over to you.
There's like 22 years of stuff to catch up on other than me being...
Let's not go down that road.
The main thing at the moment. No. Hi, Alexandra. Thanks so much for jumping on and agreeing to do this. I do really appreciate it.
No problem. It's nice to meet you.
I hope the lag isn't too bad.
It's fine. We'll get back.
Okay. I want to start off by saying I'm like a huge fan of Danger 5. I watched it like years ago, and I really, really like it.
I didn't really do very much on that project, to be honest.
But I
know the filmmakers, and they're lovely and really great, and the producer's amazing as well. I worked at the Post House, which was delivering that project to SBS, who's the Australian broadcasters. So I kind of helped with that process. So no, you know, exciting claim to that one, other than knowing some very cool people. And helping get it to the broadcaster.
Well, still, like, I'm glad you say they're nice, because I feel like nowadays it's always like a gamble liking something and praising anyone. But that's great to hear. Thank you. Okay, I mean, I had a couple of questions for you, if that was okay.
Yeah, go for it.
Well, first off, like Ashley said, I'm a writer, but I'm fresh out of film school. So as for right now, I'm pretty eager to get into script reading. And I was wondering if maybe you had any advice on maybe potential avenues I could go through to get
to that. Yeah, totally. So I think that's a great idea. I think as a writer, the more scripts that you can read, the better. I think that's a fantastic approach. And there are a number of companies out there who do use script readers. It doesn't pay very well, but it pays a little bit most of the time, which is good. So I think that you should probably reach out to a bunch of companies and see if they're actively using script readers at the moment. Different companies work in different ways. So I've worked for several companies in development where they don't tend to use script readers because they have in-house internal development people who read all of the scripts. In some cases, companies can actually get people to read books instead of scripts because sometimes their in-house execs don't have the time to read a novel. So they might outsource that. So you might find that is an opportunity. But there are also script competitions out there which often look for script readers. So I think like Sure Scripts might be one, and there are a couple of other kind of, you know, competitions out there that do use script readers to assess their screenplays and write reports. So if I was you, I'd do some research on all the script competitions, contact them, see if they're looking for readers. And then I'd also make a list of the production companies that I love and approach them directly. Sometimes it can be quite difficult to get a response when you email the info@email address. So if you can do any research on who works there and find any personal email addresses, that's always helpful. And just, you know, explain to them why you've always wanted to, you know, be involved with their company. And then, you know, just say that you're script reading. And I would probably offer to do one for free first as like a trial one, or that you can send them an example of previous coverage. But I think if you're able to do one for free, often that's like a good in, because they're more likely to take you up on the offer. And then you might get, you know, a paid one after that. Ash and I were talking before about unpaid work and my feelings on it. In general, I don't advocate for unpaid work. But I think if it's just reading one script and it's kind of showing them what you can do, then I think if you're in a position to do that, then that's great. So that would probably be my approach to that side of things. But my headphones have just died, so I think you're going to switch to computer sound now. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Just about, yeah.
Let me just see what's going on here. Hold on. I think I might need to change the...
As long as you can hear us.
Can hear you.
Hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Perfect.
All good.
Cool. That was a great answer. That I hadn't considered the competitions at all. So thank you so much. A couple more, if that's okay. I also wanted to ask, I was looking through your credits. I've seen you've worked, especially now as like a producer on a lot of short films, and some features as well. I wanted to ask, like, in your experience, what would you say like the big differences between projects that actually do get made and those that don't?
That's a really interesting question. I guess having worked in development, I have, you know, seen a lot of projects that, you know, haven't got made in my time being involved with them, but that's not to say that they will never get made. I think it has to do with a lot of factors. So A, like how good is the script? So if it's a good script, it's obviously more likely to get made. B, what else is out there in the market at the time? Is there anything else that's similar? And does it feel current? Does it feel now? Like, is there a reason that this film should be made now? Like, I've worked for some companies that had amazing slates and some really amazing projects that have been sitting there for like 7-8 years. And despite the script being really good, it just wasn't something that anyone was particularly interested in at that particular moment. But then the market can change at any point and that project, you know, may sit there and then suddenly one day end up getting made. But it really varies. And I think with short films, the ones that get made, often there's a lot of interest around the director, or there's a lot of interest around the writer. So for you as a writer, I think just having a really strong script, that's a great place to be. But the hard thing about being a writer is it's never completely in your control whether that thing will get made or not. But I think the nice thing is you can kind of know that it's not necessarily always because of your script. So I've got some good projects that, you know, haven't been made. The script's wonderful. The writer did an amazing job. But the funding body didn't want to make a film, you know, about that particular theme at that time, or, you know, they didn't have any money, or, you know, the director was too green, or, you know, it might have been that, yeah, various different reasons can make things not get up and running. But I think generally it's a combination of good script and timing, which is partially luck.
All right. Well, you said that even though the scripts can be great, sometimes they won't get made. But the relationships that people build with the writer in those situations, would they be more willing to revisit maybe some of their other work?
Definitely. I think the great thing about writing is if you have a good script that kind of says who you are and people want to kind of, you know, keep working with you as a writer, even if that project hasn't been made, like it helps once you've had something that's been made, but you're in a good position. Unlike directors, it's a bit more challenging because they really have to make stuff to show people how good they are. And writing a script is making stuff, but it's making something without all the money having to be raised. So yeah, that's a really great thing for you. So I do think that people read a script and they might think we're not going to make this, but we'd love to keep you in mind for future. And you know, you can keep those relationships, and I'm sure they'll be willing to read things from you next time. You know, next time you have something. So for sure, it's still beneficial even if something doesn't get made. But it's great if it does, obviously, because you just get a bit more attention. And with short films, it can be nice to be like, oh, you know, I had this thing and it got made and here's how it turned out. But at the same time, you could write a feature screenplay and, you know, get lucky and it gets up and running. So one of my projects, so a short film I did called Sarah Chong Is Going to Kill Herself, that short script was the first thing the writer had ever written. She had never written anything before. She wrote that. We made the film. We then got a feature film into development with Film 4 off the back of that.
Wow.
Because they really believed in her as a writer and they believed in the team. So things like that can happen. That's like the really lucky spectrum. And then there's, you know, a lot of stories which aren't like that. But yeah, I think writing something and, you know, connecting with people and just continuing those relationships, even if it doesn't get made, that's the way to go. I mean, you look at, say, for example, so I had a project with Laurie Nunn, who created Sex Education. Laurie had projects in development with like majority of the broadcasters prior to that happening, but none of them had ever actually gotten made. And she was considered quite a successful writer even prior to Sex Education being made in the industry, because she'd written these amazing scripts. They were all really good. Everyone loved her as a writer. You know, most of the funding bodies had one of her projects in development at some point that just hadn't gone ahead for whatever reason. It wasn't the right time. And then she makes Sex Education and bam, like everything's great. So yeah, it can take a bit of time, but you don't have to have something made to kind of, you know, consider yourself a good writer or to be successful in some ways.
Cool. That's great to hear you say that. Sorry, just real quick, going back to the Sarah Chong Is Going to Kill Herself. Mm-hmm. She's a first time writer. What happens to get that script from her onto your, well, in front of you?
So I met her and the director at Raindance. So we met at a film festival and it was at the awards night. So it was like a kind of a party. So I had a short film that was nominated for an award and she had worked on a short film. She hadn't written it, but she'd worked on another short that was up for an award. So this is a funny one. We actually all met on the dance floor and we were just dancing. So we kind of just became friends that way. And then at the end of the night, I gave them my card and I was like, we should stay in touch. And I didn't think I'd ever hear from them. It was one of those weird things. And then they emailed me literally 2 days later and said, we have this script that we want to put in, or they'd actually put it into an initiative. And I think it had been shortlisted and they were looking for a producer. And so I thought, okay. And I read it and I thought, this is the most insane thing I've ever read in my life. But I kind of put it. So that's how that started. And other filmmakers, I've met them usually either through like recommendations, or I've met them at events and things and we know each other that way, or I've seen their film and I've contacted them. Or for some people that are a bit further along the track, they've got an agent and I've emailed their agent and said, I want to know about your new writers and directors. Do you have anyone? Then they'll send them through to me. So there are several ways, but often they're relationships which have ended up being quite long lasting. I've met them in quite an organic way. And we've just clicked and found that there's a really good kind of connection there and a creative collaboration.
Okay, it's great. There you mentioned the agents as well. How important would you say it is getting an agent early on?
I don't think it's that important early on, because an agent can't really do that much for you until you've got certain things in place. So I think a lot of filmmakers think that their career can't start without an agent, and I don't think that's true. An agent tends to be most helpful if you're wanting to get into television and you're at a point where you are able to get into television and they can put you forward for it. That's when they become really pivotal. Or if you've got a feature that's going to be going into development with a funding body, or it's going to get made and they're going to be looking across the contracts and that sort of thing. And they are good at connecting with you with people, and they will put you in touch with people and promote you. But you can promote yourself as well, and you can put yourself in touch with people. So there's a lot that you can do prior to getting an agent. So I feel like, don't feel like your career hasn't started until you get an agent. And yes, they will be really helpful once you have them, but it's not essential when you're just starting out. And a lot of people get an agent once they've achieved certain milestones, so like they've made a public funding body short film, or they've received an award at a significant festival and that kind of thing. But up until that point, you can still do a lot of stuff, meet a lot of people, and be moving your career forward. There's so much you can do.
Perfect. I've got one last question, if you still have time.
Like Columbo. You're like Columbo down there, man. Just one more question.
One more thing real quick. I wanted to ask if there's anything I can be doing that's sort of writing adjacent that would still be pushing my career forward.
Mm-hmm. So you're kind of thinking, outside of writing like a spec script, what should you be doing outside of that actual writing process?
Yeah.
So I think finding creative collaborators, so finding directors that, you know, there might be a bit of buzz around, or that you think are really talented, finding those kind of relationships is really important. So looking for those people that you're going to work with, and looking for producers as well that like have the same taste as you, you know, have the same vibe, finding those like-minded people that you want to collaborate with. And then I think reading scripts, as you already said, that's a great place to start. But not only reading, you know, scripts for companies, but maybe looking at scripts of, you know, like really successful films. Like, they're often a good exercise to kind of read. And getting involved in initiatives and schemes. Actually, this is the one thing that I think you should focus on. So looking at things like Edinburgh Talent Lab, you know, looking at anything that the BFI is running, Film London initiatives. A lot of this industry revolves around kind of buzz and like picking certain boxes and getting onto these schemes and having your name on a list and in a press release. That's really valuable. So just looking for things that you can apply for. And also, there are some script competitions that are worth doing. There are some which I think are actually just money-making exercises, but there are other ones which can, you know, help you get a bit of a profile. So things like, for example, BAFTA Rocliffe, like that's a great one to apply for. There's the Nichols Fellowship, those kind of opportunities. So looking for those more prestigious competitions, and then looking for development schemes that might be good, particularly those that are with, you know, the well-known funding bodies. So keeping an eye out for those opportunities, because not only do you learn a lot, but you also meet people that you might collaborate with. It's a great place to kind of find those key collaborators.
Perfect. Well, I don't want to take up too much of your time, but this has been incredibly helpful. Thank you so much. Congratulations on Holy, I don't know how to say it, Cannelloni as well. I saw it got into just about everything, so.
Thank you, Ash, thanks
so much for setting this up, man.
My pleasure. Thanks for joining. You got some writing to do.
Yeah, sounds like I do. As an unemployed film graduate, I have just all the time in the world right now, so.
Just like most people in the film industry for the most part as well, yeah, at the moment.
Okay, well, I'm going to jump off. Like, thanks so much again, guys.
Really take it easy. See you later.
Bye.
Bye. Bless. All right, thanks, everybody. We've rattled through them all. Yeah, I think there's lots of valuable stuff in there for all of them. My heart bleeds a little bit for fresh grads, whether it's acting grads or film school grads at the moment with the current lockdown situation. Because
awful. I really feel for them too.
Like, it's difficult anyway, but to not even know what the industry is going to look like must be, I don't know. I can't get my head around it.
Yeah. I feel for the people who are about to start as well, because like having to start your film degree in a socially distanced way, which makes shooting films all that more difficult. Like, that's not ideal for them either.
It's interesting. I have a friend who's a film, he's a tutor at one of the film schools, and he says they're trying to figure out what they're going to do because they don't quite know. It's not just about the filming of the final project. It's also about the skill sets that you pick at different sort of parts of your journey throughout film school. So he made a good point when I spoke to him yesterday, where he said, you know, the second years actually are the ones that they're most worried about in some ways, because they could fall through the gaps. Because, you know, in the second year, you need to learn the core skills and make something to be ready for your final year project. And if they don't get to do that this year, when they do get to their final year, they might need a lot more help and attention, because how much distance learning and films over Zoom can you actually do?
Yeah, so tough, really tough.
We'll see. Who knows? Who knows what'll happen? At least conversations seem to be taking place, which is positive. Right, let's get off the doom and gloom side of things, because the industry is still going to be here. We need to tell stories. I guess just a few things to sort of wrap it up in no real order. We've not really touched too much on the idea of pitching, which is a big old can of worms, but forgetting TV series, because I know you haven't delved too much into that from what I'm aware, maybe focusing more on features.
A little bit
in TV,
but not a lot.
Yeah, like more from the feature film side, I guess. You know, director comes in, writer comes in, they've got an idea, they've got their log line and treatment. Is that enough? Do they need a full script? Like, what do they need to pitch? And in your experience, what are some of the key things they need to then do in those pitch meetings?
Mm-hmm. So it depends who they're pitching to, and it also depends what country you are pitching, because okay. The US and the UK are very different in pitching styles.
No.
So here in the UK, we're actually much more informal when it comes to pitching. Like if someone comes to me with a really polished pitch, with it, they've clearly learned off by heart, I'm kind of a bit like, okay. It's more of a conversation. And it's a bit more natural and organic. So if you're pitching to me as a producer, I mean, it depends on the environment as well. If you're pitching to me at a film festival where it's a speed dating event and you've been given 5 minutes in which to pitch to me, yeah, sure. Have your like elevator pitch down and, you know, like know what you're doing. And maybe it helps if you kind of have something which has a certain kind of, you know, duration. In that case, maybe it's slightly more formal, but most of the time I'm getting pitched to, it's in the meeting, or it's like at a party or a networking event. And in that case, it's just a conversation about your project. And I think as long as you know your story inside out, like that's really important, and you have to be able to convey that passion to me. Like for me, it's like passion and, you know, getting a sense that there is like a hook or an emotional connection with that story that I can kind of relate to. So I don't expect someone to necessarily have a really formal presentation. Mm-hmm. And they can come to me with a project at any stage. You can talk to me about an idea. That's fine. I can do more with a project once there's something written down, but it depends on, you know, where we're going with it, and also whether it's television or film. Mm-hmm. So with film, often with my writers, because I've made a short film with them, often we'll talk about the feature idea and then they'll go away and write a first draft or an outline. But there's no right or wrong answer. And then when you go to a funding body, then you have to figure out what that funding body needs to kind of, you know, take on board. So if it's BFI, you know, and you're going for funding for a draft, you know, it's sometimes useful to have a first draft and be submitting that. You can go for early stage development funding, in which case you just have to have an outline. But it depends on specifically what it is that you're asking them for as to what you kind of need in the first place. But in general, I would say it's very useful to have a log line, a short synopsis, so like under 25 words, and then a longer synopsis, which still isn't massively long, but like maybe like couple of paragraphs, half a page. These are just useful things to have on hand, because often when you're applying for things, when I'm filling out application forms, they always ask for a log line. There's always a short synopsis. And so I tend to have different versions that I've worked on with the writer. So, you know, 25 words, 50 words, 500 words. In some instances, if we need to do a 1,000-word version, then fine. But it's tailored to whatever specifically we're applying for. And that might be a lab, a film festival lab, or it might be a funding body for development funding. And it varies depending on what it is that you're asking and what you're looking for.
And I guess from sort of reading between the lines there, a big key component is the authenticity of the person and the drive they have to tell that story. I had Lucy Meir on from Strive Films, who's on the Insights program that you're on. And she basically said, you know, if she was going to give any advice, the key thing she normally looks for people to have clear is why you and why now with any story? Like why not, you know, like the story has to be great, but like you're saying to Hugo, a script might not be perfect for this moment in time. So I guess, do you agree, like, it's really key to have that in your head clear as to why are you the right person and why is now the right time to tell it?
Definitely. I think that's really good advice. And I think as well, when you're telling that story, keep in mind, like, when you're pitching, you are also pitching yourself as a storyteller. Mm-hmm. If you can't tell me a story in a short period of time, I'm probably going to doubt your abilities as like your ability to tell a story across a feature film. And tone is really important as well. So if you're a comedy writer and you're going to pitch me a comedy idea, make it funny when you're explaining it. Because if it's not funny when you're explaining it, I'm unlikely to be excited by the fact it's going to be funny when I read it. So just kind of, yeah, thinking about injecting a little bit of your personality into when you're describing your projects, I think is helpful, because you're not just selling the project, you're selling you as a filmmaker. So giving a sense of who you are and, yeah, and why you tell the story. And yeah, that can be really important. And then obviously if you're pitching to a financier, that's slightly different to pitching to a producer. So often when we're taking projects to say BFI, Film 4 and BBC, we often go in as a team. And so we're gonna, you know, pitch together. So having a bit of sense as to who's gonna say what in advance is always helpful, but not having something that's too structured that you can't kind of go off on a tangent, because often you go in there and you don't necessarily know how much time you're gonna have and how much detail you're gonna get into. And so it can become more of a conversation. So rather than just giving this really formalized 3 minutes that you've learned off by heart, you might wanna just make it a bit more organic and just have it as a conversation. They can ask you for more detail as you're telling it, but just knowing your story well and also having other options up your sleeve. So the project that I have with Film 4, we went in and we had this pitch, and we had this project that we're really passionate about. We'd spent all of our time talking about this project, and then we got in there and we described it to them. They were like, it sounds great, that sounds fantastic. They said, that sounds like a second or third film though. They said, it doesn't sound like a first feature. And we were like, oh no. And they said, do you have anything else? Are there any other ideas that you're exploring? And we had this other idea about, it was actually an idea for TV originally. And I thought maybe they might connect to this idea. So I said, yeah, we've got this other thing that we've been playing around with. We originally were developing it like for TV, but we think it's got feature film potential. Hadn't really discussed that with the team, whether there was feature film potential or not, but we were in the meeting. We needed something And so we pitched that idea instead, and they went, we love it. We think that's really interesting. Do you think you could do that as a feature? And we were like, yes.
Do you think we could do it as a feature?
And then like got out of there and we were like, right, how do we see this as a feature? Had to go away and write something down and come back with it. And that was the project we ended up developing with the financier. And had we have not had any other ideas up our sleeve, we would have kind of come out of that meeting and the opportunity would have been wasted. So just always.
And that was just an idea. That was just like a line or a treatment you wrote. It wasn't.
Had been written down. Zero.
Just a discussion you had.
Yeah, and it was just a discussion that we were having around something that we found interesting as well. It had been, you know, we heard like a bit of a true story, and then we started talking about some other ideas, you know, and it was something that we were like, we think this is an interesting thing to explore. We want to do it through comedy. This is what we think, you know, could be like roughly what we would want to say with it. And that's kind of all we had. But, you know, that's the one that got picked up. And we did make it, you know, we did develop as a feature. It's a great script. So
it was going to be one of my questions about how many things do you think someone should have on their slate? And obviously that doesn't mean written, ready for funding for each thing. It could be just an idea. But to avoid kind of the thing you mentioned there of going in and then saying, I like it, but not for us or not right now. What else you got? And you go, nothing? Because... Or for you go to a festival, or you win an award, or you get long listed for the Oscars, or get to the Oscar. You want something to capitalize on the momentum. So there's all those reasons to have something on your slate. But do you have like a number or ideas of how it should look?
It depends a little bit if you're a producer or if you're a writer. Because mm-hmm. If you're a producer, you're going to have more projects because you're not having to physically write all of them. And also you're trying to kind of, you know, to mediate the fact that some of them won't ultimately end up getting made. But it depends on how much time you have. So when I was working full-time and kind of balancing my other stuff around it, I kind of would only try to be focusing on one short film at a time. And then I had two features in development whilst I was working full-time. Now that I'm out on my own, I have, I think, 4 features and I've got about 3 or 4 TV series on the slate, but this is what I'm spending majority of my time doing. And I tend to, there's no magic number, it's more how much do I think I can handle? And also, how many things do I have that I love? Because, you know, there aren't going to be, you know, 20 projects that people want me to take on that I want to take on. So it's about finding the right things. But I think if you're a writer, it's good to maybe have like at least 3 if possible. So like one thing that you've got at script stage, and then maybe something at outline, and maybe something at idea stage, or even further, you know, developed than that if you've got the time. Depends how much time you have. But yeah, I think having a few things to talk about, and even if it's just something that you're interested in, you haven't really thought about it, that's okay. It's just, you know, knowing something that you'd like to explore within your work can be helpful.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. I guess it's just avoiding getting caught out in any meetings where you just go blank faced and have nothing else. And I guess it shows as well that you know you're in it for the marathon, not the sprint. You know that you're thinking ahead of not just making one project one and done, but that you want to curate. This sounds so corny. I'm going to say it, a legacy of work. Yeah, it did sound corny.
I think as well, though, what it does is, even if you never actually end up writing those projects, what it does is it gives people a taste of who you are as a filmmaker. And so that's what those meetings are often about, is people getting a sense of who you are and your vision and the kind of projects you like and what you have to say. So even if that's not something you end up ever turning into a script, that's going to convey to someone what you're into and help them know who you are. And that's really
And so just sort of piggybacking off that a little bit, when it comes to things like genre and tone, obviously, you know, people can do many things, but the industry might want to see you in a particular guise or sort of know what your authentic voice is. So do you recommend that, I don't know, say someone's into sci-fi and that's their kind of genre? Not a good example for funding, I get, but like, should they focus on just being like the sci-fi director or writer, or is it more sort of themes and tones that they should focus on for their...
I think you can have a couple of things, because like, you don't want to pigeonhole yourself too much. I think it depends on who you are as a director, because some directors are very much like they just do one genre, and others kind of, you know, dip in and out of various things. But I think as long as if you are in a genre, you're showing your original voice, and then if you do like a drama, as long as you know you can see what themes you're interested in, I think, yeah, there's no one right or wrong way to do it. But know that people want to get a sense of who you are, and whatever you make is going to help convey that. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, sci-fi is a great genre. You know, you can explore some really interesting things in that. And I think don't be afraid of it, because sci-fi is often a way to explore what we're doing as society. Like, it's often about some underlying problem we have as humans. And so, you know, that might be a thread that you show in a sci-fi film, but you also show in a drama. Mm-hmm. So they're not necessarily completely unrelated, but yeah, think about building a slate of things which kind of, yeah, show who you are. You don't have to completely pigeonhole yourself, but you know,
but no thematically sort of the things that resonate with you, which I guess naturally are going to be what you're drawn to as a human.
Yeah.
And then that comes through in your work.
Yeah.
Cool. Final kind of little sort of area I want to touch on is just the whole area of film festivals, because you know, once you start going to them and you get films in there, they are amazing opportunities to, as you said throughout the chat, connect with people, get your work seen. They're like a badge of honor with some of them, where it helps you then springboard to making more kind of projects and work. For people that haven't gone down the road of submitting a short or a feature to a festival, I guess a little bit of your experience, if you could share it, around the process of like how to even know what festivals to pitch your project for. Mm-hmm. Obviously you're spending money for these things. You can't just go for everybody. Like how, you mentioned you work with a company, but how do you approach that in terms of?
Sure. So I only started working with a company like maybe halfway through my sort of short film journey. And it's because it's quite time consuming. And so I kind of delegate out to them. And also they have a lot of knowledge, so it's really valuable to have their advice. But I have done a lot of it by myself before in the past. I could probably talk about this for like an hour in itself, but I'll try and just do a few nutshell kind of pointers.
Cool.
To start off with, there are a ton of festivals out there. You've got to think about where your film is right for. And if you've just made a no budget short film and it's your first short film, it may be that film is not going to screen at Cannes, and that's okay. You know, maybe don't, Canada's actually free to enter, but a number of the other A-list festivals, they do cost money, and you want to be strategic about where you invest that money. So if your film is not going to be, you know, an A-list festival film, that's fine. Don't spend the money.
Yeah, don't go to Sundance and pay the 60 or 70 bucks or whatever it is.
Yeah, no. But if your film does have potential for Sundance, then yeah, enter it, but be realistic about what you've created.
But is that potential knowing the themes and the kind of programming that those festivals tend to gravitate to?
A little bit, but I have to say it can be a guessing game. It's really actually difficult to know with certain festivals. I feel like I'm only just grasping what is a Cannes film and what is maybe a Sundance film. But then again, sometimes you just don't know. So when you've got enough money, enter as much as you can. Sure. When you don't have a lot of money, be more strategic. And you might want to start out with the bigger sort of A-list festivals. And if you're not having any luck, then maybe, you know, try a different path. But the ones that you should think about as well are really in your home country too. So thinking about if you're in the UK, what festivals, if you got into them, would you be able to go and then network? That's really worth thinking about. And also, if you do have you know, a fairly strong short, then thinking about what are the BAFTA accredited festivals, what are the BIFFA accredited festivals, what are the Oscar qualifying festivals. So that's where I usually start my strategies for my films. I mainly invest my money in BAFTA qualifying and BIFFA qualifying. But I also do try and think about, is the film right for this festival? Sometimes you won't know. Sometimes it's a guessing game. But the more you do it, the more you know and the more you have a sense. Or if you've got a lot of money available to you, you can engage a company. So I use Festival Formula. That's all they do. They just do festival submissions. So they look at my films and they'll be like, we know exactly what festivals we think this would be good for. So they're going to, you know, we agree a festival budget and they're going to do a list and I'll give feedback on it and we'll decide together. But ultimately, they're going to point me in the right direction for where my film might find a home. But it is, you know, a little bit of a guessing game and a little bit of luck.
And I guess it depends how many shorts you've done already, if any. If it's your first, maybe it's different if you've done one or two, or someone on the team has got in and got to whatever, Holly Shorts or whatever, Rain Dance. And if you've been to them before with something, maybe that connection stands instead to get back in again. Who knows?
Yeah, definitely. And if you've screened somewhere before, or someone on the team has screened somewhere before, then you can always ask for a fee waiver. They don't always say yes, but they might give you a discount. It's worth doing that. And then as well, they know that the film isn't just a random submission. It's something which they've, you know, engaged with someone on that team before, and they'll probably consider it a bit more seriously. If you've ever met any programmers at film festivals, keep their email addresses, email them directly when you've submitted, let them know, remind them that they met you. Then they'll just pay it extra attention. So I submitted a couple of films to Sundance, and I had met the programmer before. And so I emailed, and the films didn't get programmed, but he sent back a lovely email, said some really nice things about the films. And I was then able to pass that on to filmmakers and be like, it was considered by the lead programmer. And he said these nice things about your film. So even though we didn't get in, that was great.
And it's all building those connections for, again, marathon, not a sprint.
Yeah, definitely. And one thing I would say is just be quite aware of the difference between your short film screening at Cannes and the short film corner. There is enough. I get so annoyed because people email me all the time being like, my film screened at Cannes, and I look it up and it says Short Film Corner. That is not Cannes Film Festival.
Yeah.
And Cannes Short Film Market accept all of the films that get put forward. So I hope I haven't broken anyone's heart here by revealing that to them. But
it's also because it happens at the same time as the festival within the film market. So it's
there. Your film will screen there in the market in a very, but it's not the festival.
Yeah, but it's like set up at the market in a booth somewhere, and you probably don't even have a scheduled time for it. Sure.
Yeah, it's not exactly what you might think it is, and just be aware of, if you make that error, it immediately says green. People just know that you don't know what you're talking about. So sure. That's just one to be particularly aware of. But hopefully that helps.
Yeah, it's the allure of Cannes that people just jump and go, oh my god, I can get in. But yeah, do it the right way. Or if you're doing it because you want to, I guess, just, I don't know. I mean, why would you submit it to the Short Film Corner then?
Because people do go and watch short films there sometimes. Like, programmers from other festivals might go and look at the catalog to like find other films, or to, you know, contact people and say, why don't you screen at our festival? So it's not necessarily a waste of time.
Sure.
But it's just not something incredibly prestigious that you can then promote to other people to say that your film is good.
Yeah.
But you know, not every film is right for Cannes anyway. Just because your film didn't get into Cannes, then it's not a good film.
No.
Cannes is very specific, very small, like target to hit.
And you know, your film's going to resonate with different audiences as in different people or countries, depending on so many factors and themes. Mm-hmm. And I guess understanding that is equally important, as opposed to just blanket going for the labels.
And often that's a learning curve for me. Like, I have films that when I make them, I think I have an idea of who the audience is. And then so like one of my most recent short films, Martha, it was funded by the BFI. I was like, I don't really know where this is going to resonate. The US apparently is where it's going to resonate. It's been getting into a lot of film festivals there, and less so in Europe. Whereas some of my other films, like I've got one called Endo, that is doing so well in Europe. And I think we've had less, you know, kind of on the US front. So it just depends, like different audiences like different kind of films, different festivals have different slates. And also there are more short films being made than ever before. I mean, that's going to change right now because of COVID, there's going to be a lack. But up until that time, just the number of like festivals getting entry is so much. I do a bit of pre-selection for some film festivals sometimes. And I also have judged for the Australian Academy Awards for the short films. And when I first started doing that judging process, I think I was watching maybe like 50 short films, and they've now changed it. And we're getting like 200, we're getting 200 short films, and they've had to split it so that we don't all watch all of the films because there are too many films getting submitted. And that's a really big change that I've seen in the past like 5 years. So it's harder to get a festival into a festival now than ever before.
Because of access to just people having more easy, readily available equipment to make stuff on the fly. And then, yeah, it's harder, I guess, for people to just program because there's so much more to go through.
Yeah, definitely. So that's why when you make a longer short film, your film has to be twice as good as like one short film, because they could program two short films in like half an hour, or they can program one really good short film. So your film has to be better than the two you could have programmed in that.
Yeah, short. That's interesting, because I'm going to do what Hugo did and do a Columbo on you and go, one more question. But I've noticed that a lot of your short films, from what I could see, were in that 15 to 20, 22 minute range. And sort of anything that goes sort of at 20, 25 minute mark is probably considered a bit longer than what a programmer might like. They want that 10 minutes, maybe 15 minute sweet spot. So how do you navigate that in conversations with, you know, people like the BFI or people that would want it to be 10 minutes tops? Is it just...
Yeah. So it's changed a lot in recent years. So the longer films I made tend to be the older films on my list, because it used to be less of an issue. And now it's kind of like 15 minutes is kind of what you should be aiming for or under if you can. Yeah. That being said, it has to suit the narrative. So you're telling a certain story, and some stories just can't be told in a certain duration. So you kind of have to be true to the storytelling and allow yourself as much time as you need to tell that story. But what I find often is that you need way less time than you think you need. So when we did Martha, which we did with BFI, I think the script was like maybe, it was long. It was maybe like on the 17, 18 page side, I think, from memory. And we were like, oh, it'll be fine. It'll be 15 minutes when it gets into the edit. And we kind of all agreed that we were aiming for that 15 minute mark. And then when we got the first cut, the director was, it was like 22 minutes. And the director was like, I just can't see it getting under 20 minutes. And I was like, I think that we can. Let's see. And he was like, yeah, I know. I'm really open to getting it under 20 minutes. I'm just not sure that it's humanly possible. And we got it to like 16 minutes or something. So we got it down. But it's hard to see that when you start out in that editing process. It takes a really long time. You have to be really brutal. And then you realize that actually you don't miss some of the things that you lost, even though you spent a really long time shooting them. And so it can be quite painful for the director and the producer to kind of let go of stuff that you know you spent a really long time on. But if it's best for the storytelling, then that's the way.
Yeah, I guess as long as the story isn't compromised and you're still telling the same thing and the arc still is strong, if not stronger, then you take the hit and you save the stuff on the editing floor for, I don't know, behind the scenes or press footage or whatever.
You never know, yeah. I think, well, editing is a process of rewriting the film. And so you kind of have to go and, you know, you write the film when you write the script, you write the film again when you shoot it, and then you write it again in the edit, and it becomes something different every time. And you've got to be open to that. If you're trying to edit the film that you originally wrote or the film that you think you shot, I think sometimes you need to let go of that and kind of be like, what does the film actually want to be now? And what actually works? Because some of the stuff that you thought was going to work isn't working
properly. Yeah, and what did we get like in the can that's available to play with? Because maybe we don't have the full jigsaw puzzle pieces that we thought we were going to have. So it's all part of the fun and games. Awesome. Well, look, let's wrap it up. I wrap this up always with 10 quick fire questions taken from inside the actor's studio. Did you ever watch the show?
No, I haven't.
No? Do you know the show though from back in the day?
No.
I was the guy's called James Lipton, and he passed away a few months ago, but he was from the actor's studio in New York, and he would interview all these, you know, huge movie stars and ask them about their lives and the journey of their life. And then at the end, he would do these 10 questions. So I'm going to rattle them off, and whatever comes to mind, just
okay.
let me know what your answers are. So the first question is, what is your favorite word?
Ooh.
Is that it? That's a sound.
My favorite word is yes.
Okay.
Yes.
It means good things are coming your way when you've asked for things.
Usually, right? Usually yes is a good answer, usually. So.
What's your least favorite word? No.
Possibly no. I'm starting to embrace no more, actually, as part of my work-life balance that we talked about earlier.
No can be a yes.
My least favorite word is, I'm sure there's a word that I've been told before in like meetings with financiers where I've been like, oh, I hate it when they say that, but I don't know if I can think of it. I'm not doing a good job of quick fire. Let's just say I can't think of anything. I'm failing on this one.
Okay.
Let's go with no. My least favorite word is no for this.
Let's go with no for now with a caveat and an asterisk next to it. Next question is, what turns you on in a creative, spiritual, intellectual kind of a way?
Ooh, I think energy. I know that's, I have to answer in one word, right? Or can I answer in more than one?
Whatever comes to me.
I think, yeah, I think things which have a certain energy to them, which I find exciting, which are visually interesting things I'm often really drawn to, or things which have a different perspective, or things that I find very funny. So I think, yeah, anything that just feels new and different and like it has something to say, and also something that like hits to my heart. Like the reason why I take on most things is because I feel it in here and I fall in love with it a bit. I fall in love with things and then I can't let them go, because I'm like, no, you shouldn't do another short film, you don't have the time or the energy or the mental capacity to do another short film. And then I read something and I'm like, oh, but I love it.
It's like, god damn it,
else doing this, like I can't let someone else have this, it's mine. So yeah, that happens for me a lot.
But that's not a bad thing, I guess, as long as you still have that little bit of free time for yourself and you're not adding on more projects to your what on the flip to that, the next question is, what turns you off?
People that don't understand that film is a collaboration. There's nothing worse. I don't believe in auteur theory. And there's nothing worse than someone coming to me and being like, my thing is perfect. It doesn't need any input. I just need you to raise the money and make it happen.
Well, you're not working with a person, then you're working with their ego.
Yeah. Right? Ego is probably what I don't like, actually. I think ego is the more accurate description of what I don't like.
There we go. Next question's optional, because it might not be on brand for people, and I totally get it. And it's, what's your favorite swear word? And you can pass if you want.
Ooh, interesting.
But I swear like a chimney. I've not on this episode. I've been good, but feel free if you want to go for it.
I'm trying to think of like a creative one, but I don't know that I have one. There should be some like Australian. I'm sure there's some Australian swear words that no one else knows. clearly haven't been using them very often, like struth or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
I think what's interesting about swear words is I don't swear a lot, but then when I do swear, it becomes more powerful. And I've been told that my accent becomes more Australian when I'm angry and when I
really?
Swear. When I swear, I sound more Aussie, which I think is quite funny.
You go back to your mother tongue and get more primal and just,
yeah.
It's interesting, isn't it? That some languages, it feels more poignant. Like I grew up in Spain, and in Spanish, everyone swears like a chimney. So it doesn't sound quite as bad when they say some pretty aggressive words when you translate them to English. If you said it in English, people would look at you like you need to be in an insane asylum. And it's so interesting culturally how people just resonate differently with those words. Next question is, what is your favorite sound or noise?
Laughter.
And then what is your least favorite sound or noise?
Oh, I don't like really squeaky noises, like people fingers on a blackboard, that kind of stuff. I find that quite upsetting.
Yep. Next question is, if you could do any other job other than your own or ones that you've already done, what would that be?
I think I would either work for a charity. I think I'd get like quite a lot of joy out of that. Like maybe like project managing, raising money, trying to make a difference in the world. I think I'd maybe do that. Or teach, because I like helping people. And I think part of producing is nurturing. So I think I'd enjoy doing something like that.
I think that's really interesting, the part of producing is nurturing part, just because of what we spoke to earlier with the idea of producers sometimes being misunderstood or getting a bad rap of what they really are. And I think it is that sort of, you know, you're kind of a bit of a mother goose for some people in some ways, helping them through their creative journeys as well. And yeah, I get the vibe of that with the teaching and the charity, that wanting to give back and to help.
Yeah. And I think, you know, wanting to create things, I think part of the joy of producing is creating. And I think with, you know, with that other kind of work as well, it's like bringing things to fruition and kind of making things happen and helping realize things. I think that's the joy of producing. So I think they're the other kind of careers that where maybe I could try and find some of that similar joy.
And then on the flip of that, what would be the one job or profession you would never want to attempt?
Maybe a professional sports player.
Oh, okay.
I'd be really bad.
Right.
I'm not particularly
just
skilled.
Just any and all sports, all of them.
Yeah, any and all sports. It'd be a disaster.
Okay.
So that wouldn't be that, or an accountant. I don't think I would like accounting very much.
Which is a different kind of sport, but it's like a blood sport.
Yeah.
Last question. It's a little bit more ethereal, but to wrap it up, the question is, when it's all said and done, what would you like the story of your life to be? What kind of impact would you like to have had?
Life in general or my specific like career?
Life in general. I mean, career weaves into that, but I'm talking to you as a person, not as a producer.
Yeah, I think I would like my life story to be, Alex was a really good human. She made people happy and she sought to make a difference in the world and, you know, to leave some kind of legacy, to kind of, you know, leave something behind that she made, whether, you know, that was, you know, really strong relationships or films or, you know, just like make some kind of difference to somebody. Yeah, just leaving something behind that kind of, you know, that meant something to somebody.
Awesome. Love that. I mean, that's the beauty of making art and working on creating films, right? That you put stuff out there that's always going to be there and there is that legacy. So you're in the right field. Awesome. Well, look, it's been great chatting to you. I guess the last few moments to you, really, like anything that you want to sort of say as a closing comment to round it off for people that are tuning in, and also, I guess, anywhere they can connect with you, find out more. Plug anything you want. Last moments to you.
Sure. So I think I would just say good luck with your creative endeavors and, you know, keep going. I know it's a difficult time, but, you know, we'll get through it together. And, you know, find your creative collaborators and ask people for advice. You know, that's what I would encourage you to do. If you want to stay in touch with what I'm doing, you can follow Bluebird Productions on social media, which you can find that on my website, which is www.bluebirdproductions.co.uk. I have a film that just launched online yesterday, actually. It's called Cinderella Games. It's a collaboration with the English National Ballet.
Oh, I saw some of the, I think I saw some stuff on your showreel of that. And I was like, what is this?
Yeah.
How did they shoot it? That looked epic.
So that is now available to watch for free. It's only 5 minutes, so a nice, easy watch. And it was shot in the Royal Albert Hall and Kempton Museum. So two incredible locations with a ton of amazing dancers. So do check that one out. And I've got another short film called Welcome to Iron Knob, which was nominated for the Australian Academy Award. And that went online a couple of weeks ago as well. And that's doing really well with views. So if you want to check that out too, just Google Welcome to Iron Knob.
Yeah, ping me over the links to those and I'll put them in the descriptions on everywhere so people can just jump on and watch them. Because I want to watch that one that you filmed at the Albert Hall. I was like, that looked cinematically just an amazing like bunch of shots. And I only saw three shots or four, so that looked great.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Awesome. Well, listen, Alex, I'll kind of wrap it up there. I'll cut it sort of a few moments ago. And Yeah, thanks for doing this. I really appreciate it. I know we've gone for a little while. I hope I'm not eating up.
Yeah, I know, that's fine. I've got to run, so I've got a call in a few minutes. But
go for it.
Chat, and I hope it's been helpful.
No, it's been great. Take it easy. Enjoy the rest of your day.